abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Thursday, January 30th, 2014. We're going to be talking about Ukraine today. What is going on over there? There's some coverage, but maybe not as much as the situation demands. And I want to bring you guys up to speed by talking to Daniel McAdams of the Ron Paul Institute. Before we talk to Daniel, a couple things I want to share with you guys. I guess you guys probably know about the attack piece in the New York Times over the weekend. Supposed to be on Rand Paul, but really it was on the Mises Institute and Ron Paul and Lou Rockwell and on me briefly and on Walter Block and basically on the good guys, in other words. And I didn't really comment much on this because, you know, I said a little something on Facebook, but I thought Lou Rockwell's response was absolutely brilliant and didn't require anything else to be said. It is not the case that if only the Mises Institute would just play nice and never say anything controversial, then reasonable people like New York Times reporters will just leave them alone and we can all work together toward our shared goals. No, ain't no such thing. That is just not going to happen. The New York Times is not in the business of promoting the truth. And whatever offense any one of us has ever been guilty of in our entire lives, it doesn't come within a million miles of the New York Times' Judith Miller uncritically repeating war propaganda that any idiot had to know was false all the way up to the eve of the war. Right? And nobody I know, nobody from the Mises Institute ever did anything that comes anywhere remotely close to that. So the whole thing is stupid and annoying, but I want to talk just briefly about Walter Block, because I love Walter. I love Walter. He is a self-sacrificing guy. He's written hundreds and hundreds of peer-reviewed articles. You know how much you get paid for writing and publishing a peer-reviewed article? Zero. Zero. He's doing that for the cause. He's doing that to leave behind a body of work that will advance libertarian thought. That's self-sacrificing. He's very generous with his time. He's very generous with his money. He's an incredibly sweet person. Very knowledgeable. He's a walking bibliography. And the Times suggested that Walter thinks slavery really isn't so bad. Walter Block thinks slavery isn't so bad. Now, his whole career is dedicated to stopping people from being forced to do things they don't want to do. I'm pretty sure that's the textbook definition of slavery. Now, Walter says that he talked to the New York Times reporter for hours. Oy, 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 Walter, talk about a waste of your time. But he says he did this for hours, and God love him for trying. But your audience doesn't care about the non-aggression principle. That's the problem. They don't care. What they care about is finding you saying something controversial that they can hang around your neck and summarize your whole career by. They're going to summarize Walter Block's whole career based on one line that he said. And it was a line that the Times reporter knew perfectly well what Walter meant by it. He knew perfectly well what Walter's point was, but it doesn't matter. Walter uttered those words, so now the reporter is going to try to ruin him with it. And basically what it was Walter was trying to explain the libertarian principle of free association and the principle that nobody should be forced to do anything against his will. And what he said about slavery, in effect, was this: that what was wrong with slavery was not the labor per se. It was not picking cotton per se that was the problem with slavery. A lot of people in a lot of times and places have had to engage in backbreaking labor. When you live in a very poor society, the only way you can survive is through backbreaking labor. There's nothing morally bad or morally good about that. Morality has nothing to do with that. That's just reality. That's reality. And so Walter's point is that it's not the labor part of slavery that was bad, although the labor may have indeed been very physically taxing. The point is, physically taxing labor is not morally wrong. It's not morally right or wrong. It's something that sometimes people have to do. That's not the problem with slavery. The problem with slavery is that people were forced to do it against their will. They were forced to do it against their will and then turn over the proceeds to somebody else. That's the problem with slavery, that it violated the non-aggression principle. And so Walter used a very unfortunate formulation to express this. He said, look, apart from the fact that you're forced to do it, slavery isn't so bad. You get to pick cotton and sing songs. Well, of course he doesn't. I mean, only an idiot would take him literally there. He's taking some poetic license, obviously, to make his point that the problem with slavery is that you're forced to do it. Duh. And that this is what makes it a moral outrage. And so the entire career of Walter Block, libertarian hero, is reduced to, yeah, Walter Block thinks slavery wasn't so bad. It's not that the author, I think it's Sam Tannenhaus, I mean, I assure, Sam, I know you don't have an IQ of 50. I know that. I know you're not that stupid. I know what you're doing. You know what you're doing. And you know that I know that you know what you're doing. Right? The whole thing is just about smearing people. It's not about understanding. It's not about trying to understand people better. And then Walter wrote to the Times and said, this is a ridiculous caricature of my views. And the Times said, no, we're pretty satisfied with this summary of your views. That's just plain evil. Okay, that is plain evil. So don't think for one minute that if we just played nice, the Times would reciprocate. They won't. That's not what they're in the business to do. They're in the business to destroy people. Well, first they're in the business to propagandize for American wars. That's task number one. And then secondly, it's to destroy people. That's what they're about. Now, if I'd been Walter, here's how I would have done things differently. First of all, I would not hand them a phrase that I know they're going to use against me. A phrase that I know what it means, and I know they know what it means. But they're out to destroy me, so of course they'll twist anything and take anything out of context. So I won't give them anything that could be taken out of context. I did this, for example, in an interview with the Daily Beast years ago. They were attacking Ron Paul and Judge Napolitano, and I gave such a good interview to their reporter. It was epic. It was so good. And I just kept ramming home the fact that Ron and the judge are so much better on issues that are supposed to matter to progressives than so-called progressive representatives and politicians are, that Ron and the judge are the real thing, and I just kept hounding them on that. So, of course, they didn't use one word from the interview. Nothing. Nothing. They tried to hang me with other things. They didn't use anything from that interview because they knew there was nothing. So, if I'd been Walter, I would have said, look, the objectionable aspect of about slavery, the objectionable thing about slavery was not the labor involved. Because a lot of people have to work very hard. What's objectionable is you don't get to earn the money for working hard. And you don't get to choose how much you work. And you don't get to choose the kind of work you do. That's what makes slavery wrong, that it's one person using aggression against another and taking away that person's freedom of choice. And that's why we stand for the freedom of choice, because we are against all kinds of slavery. What are they going to take out of context there? How can they use that against me? They can't. Second piece of advice I would give is that if you're in that situation, you're going to give a long interview to the New York Times, record it. Tell them you're recording it. And if you don't know how to record a phone conversation, hire a consultant to come in and show you. But you have to do this. Record it. And then you can show the world, here's what I said. And even if the world doesn't care what you said, well, you know what? It's a great YouTube. You got a full interview with the New York Times. I bet a lot of people would love to hear what Walter Block said to the New York Times in a 3-hour interview or 2-hour interview or whatever. I'd love to hear that interview. But now it's gone forever. It's lost in the ether. Record it. That's what I would do. Now, basically, I don't talk to the New York Times anymore. They write to me. They want some comment. I tell them, no, I've been smeared by you guys before. Or instead of saying, well, you know, Woods is a, you know, has a Columbia PhD and, you know, highly regarded books with very good reviews in the professional journals and a lot of credentials. No, they'll say Woods is a hate-filled neo-Confederate. That's how they'll describe me. So I'm not going to participate in that. And so I've written back to say, look, sorry, your colleagues are to blame. It's not my fault. You can blame them for treating me absurdly over the years. If you want a comment from me and you can't get it, it's their fault, not mine. And that's where I leave it. For me, I'm done with this, at least with the New York Times. I can't say I would rule out all other possible outlets for interviews. I mean, I do once in a while do it, although these days I'm so busy with RonPaulHomeschool.com preparing lessons for the courses there that I just haven't got the time to do much with the media. But I would record it, and I would be very careful with how I phrase things so there's nothing they can take out of context. All right, anyway, enough of that. Let's turn now to Daniel McAdams. You all know Daniel. He advised Ron Paul for many years in his congressional office. He was the advisor on foreign policy and civil liberties, etc., and on defense policy. And he's the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, where he writes frequently. I urge you to check that out. RonPaulInstitute.org is the website. And today he's going to talk to us about what's going on in Ukraine. So, Daniel McAdams, welcome back to the program.
Thanks very much, Tom. It's great to be back with you.
Now, Daniel, I decided to have you on again so soon because somebody wrote to me and said, what's going on in Ukraine is unbelievable and outrageous, and it's barely getting any coverage, at least in comparison to what it ought to be getting. And so, doggone it, the Tom Woods Show ought to be talking about this. And I thought, well, but you know, I bet the average person looking at his iPod and he sees there's a show about Ukraine is just going to skip right over it. You know, and I don't want that. I want people to see what's going on here. So I brought you on to try to explain what's happening. You've written a little bit about this recently over at RonPaulInstitute.org. But let's start off, before we get into what's going on in the streets these days or what has been going on, let's go back a little bit in history to 2004 and 5 and the so-called Orange Revolution. I bet most people, even the informed people who listen to this program, probably don't know a whole lot about what happened there. And I think it might be useful background to start talking about that. So what was the Orange Revolution, so-called?
Sure. Actually, you know, Tom, we could go back even further. We could go back to 1939, really, and talk about a part of Western Ukraine that had been Poland, that was given to the Soviet Union back in 1939. So that's probably a better origin of the problem. You do have a country that's so strategically positioned between so-called East and West, between Russia and the EU, and there is a very strong divergence of opinion between the, say, the largely Polish minority in the western part and the strongly pro-Russian or more identifying with Russian sections in the east and in the south, the Crimea, obviously very pro-Russian. But, you know, after the end of communism and a lot of the Soviet Union broke up, obviously, and the different constituent republics went different ways, and some stayed closer and some moved further from Russia's orbit. But the U.S., starting in the 2000s, really started fomenting what we now call color revolutions. There was the Rose Revolution in Georgia, and really the signature one took place in Ukraine, as you say, in 2004, 2005, the Orange Revolution. And I think it is now openly admitted and openly available to see that the U.S. committed tens of thousands, probably tens of millions, I should say, probably as many as $60 million to help foment this revolution. What happened, and I'm going to give a kind of a real vulgar nutshell here rather than go into a lot of heavy details, but breaking it down in the simplest way, you know, there was a leader that had been closer to the U.S. He'd spent a lot of time over here in the U.S. As a matter of fact, I met him, I guess, back in 2001, very close to the neocons here in the U.S. His name was Yushchenko. And there was another candidate competing for the election, Yanukovych, who had much closer ties to Russia. Well, the revolution was I mean, the election was contested. The U.S., the EU, the rest of the world said that that Yanukovych, the more Russia-oriented, had cheated, didn't deserve to be president. And here comes into the street these U.S.-funded and equipped revolutionaries, protesters, really, demanding a new election. And, you know, the first giveaway that this had some U.S. money behind it, in Ukraine is a very, very impoverished country, very, very poor, shockingly poor, actually, in many places. But all of a sudden you saw these enormous flat-screen TVs in the middle of Kiev by these so-called democracy protesters. And all of these color-coordinated orange hats and shirts and all of these things. So thank you, Uncle Sam. Well, the protesters prevailed. They held new elections. The Orange Coalition won, Yushchenko, and his allies won. They proceeded to trash the economy, and several of them are now in prison under corruption charges. And as soon as the Ukrainians had the opportunity to vote again, they voted for Yanukovych, which is the guy who arguably they had voted for the first time. But the people who had fomented the Orange Revolution in the mid-2000s were not giving up. And as a matter of fact, I would suggest went back to do the same thing, but in a much more radicalized way. And some people have even suggested that this is the new phase of the color revolutions, a much more violent phase where the demonstrators go for a real revolution and overthrow and a coup in the streets rather than simply calling for new elections. And I think there's plenty of evidence that that's taking place here.
All right, so let's talk about exactly what is taking place here. What's going on right now? There are riots in the streets, and the blame for the violence has been placed by the Western powers on the regime in Ukraine. They say that they are to blame, whereas you look at some of the footage, and it really does seem like the protesters are initiating quite a bit of violence themselves. So sort this out for us. What's happening there?
Well, they are increasingly violent. Their leaders are heads of opposition parties in Ukraine, and I should say that these opposition parties are noted for their extreme nationalism, for their extremism. They're also known for their very close ties to the U.S. As a matter of fact, our great friend Senator John McCain was there in December, and he actually sat down with the leaders of these three parties, two of which are overtly anti-Semitic parties. There was an incident the Jewish Telegraph Agency reported last year where they were running around beating people's heads in with T-shirts saying, beat the Jids, you know, which is the slang for Jewish people. So these are the kinds of people that generally are not welcomed by the people at the State Department and the people in the Senate, but they are closely allied. Now, McCain is meeting with them and talking with them. But what happened is in November, there was an EU association agreement that had been negotiated between the Yanukovych government and Brussels. It was a big decision as to whether they would accept the association agreement, were the terms good enough, was it good for Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera. And at the last minute, the president decided to postpone, not cancel, but postpone making this agreement. And what it would have entailed is tens of billions of dollars from Brussels to help modernize manufacturing and that sort of thing in Ukraine. But, you know, Ukraine's biggest trading partner is Russia. And in many ways, it is a good fit because, you know, the Ukraine's manufacturing sector is not churning out things that are up to German standards. And, you know, at least at this point, there's more of a symbiosis. Well, the Russians came in and offered a $15 billion bailout. So orders of magnitude greater than the EU offer, and the government found it attractive and accepted it. But as soon as they had rejected the offer in November of EU association, that's when these people took to the streets and started protesting and ratcheted it up. And as you point out, there have been thousands of people killed. As a matter of fact, Wednesday of this week, another police officer was killed. One had been killed on Fridays a week before. So several cops have been killed. Several protesters have been killed. As you know, Tom, at the Ron Paul Institute, we don't carry the way. We don't take sides in these things, but we do point out the hypocrisy of the U.S. In fomenting this unrest, in financing and funding a lot of these opposition parties, and training them and giving them the tools to do these things. We're non-interventionists, so we don't like that, and we don't like people like McCain, who encouraged these people to get more and more violent.
Well, now, Daniel, forgive me if I'm especially thick here, but I want to make sure I'm following this. If you're saying that a lot of these protesters are aligned with right-wing parties that are, to put it mildly, pretty unfashionable in elite European circles, then what policy toward the EU do those people want? I mean, wasn't the Ukrainian government already moving toward basically an anti, like, what position do the protesters want the government to have taken?
Well, it is strange. I mean, it in many ways it reminds me of what's going on in Syria, where the U.S. and its allies are financing radical jihadists, the ISIS, the Islamic Front, people that have been allied with Al-Qaeda. You have to wonder, well, why on earth are they siding with these people? It doesn't make any sense. And I think it's a marriage of convenience. They need these people on the street to overthrow the existing order.
But I guess my question is, why are these people of all people on the street? I mean, if you're telling me, unless I misunderstood, if you're telling me that that Ukraine is more interested in being friendly with Russia than it is being part of the EU, wouldn't a nationalist support that decision? Like, what are they complaining about?
Well, the extreme Ukrainian nationalists despise Russia.
So even that's too open to the world. I get it now.
Yeah, you have that faction that is very Ukraine nationalist, and it gets into this, as you say, very extreme right wing national identity, blood and soil sort of thing. So there's definitely an element in that.
Now, why does the U.S. feel like it has a dog in this hunt? Why does this matter to the U.S.? Is it that they really want to see Ukraine integrated into the EU? I mean, like, what? Who cares, right? Why do they care? What's the U.S. interest?
Sure, it's a very good question, and I think part of it is just policy inertia. There is no new thinking in the foreign policy establishment in the U.S. There's still this obsessive Russophobia that, you know, our enemy is Russia. We have to do anything we can to stick our thumb in their eye. We saw it a few years ago when McCain was jumping up and down about Georgia, who had provoked the Russian attack back in 2008, and you see, you know, the U.S. putting missiles and all of these things in Poland. So there is this sort of reflexive anti-Russian sentiment, which really is unnecessary and counterproductive, especially how many years since communism has ended.
And yet it would seem to me, and I insert this cautionary note, I'm a sentimental sap, but it would seem to me that given the history between Russia and Ukraine, when Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union, we all know the terrible history they endured in the early 1930s. I mean, millions of them were starved to death on purpose. Like, there's no denying that. Well, there are a few commies who try to deny that. But the evidence on this is just overwhelming. Just read Robert Conquest. It's unbelievable what was done to these people. And yet, here we are within one human lifetime, with the possibility of some kind of reconciliation where they want to draw closer together, have closer economic ties. Like, if you're somebody like me, you would want to say, well, this is wonderful, you know, that maybe this terrible, awful history that they've had can really now be replaced by friendship. You know, I mean, I'm sorry for being so sappy and sentimental, but yet I get the sense that the U.S. government doesn't share my sentiments here.
But, you know, trade is the great healer, isn't it? It's the great diplomat. Trade is the great diplomat, and the real irony is that there really shouldn't have been an either or proposal given to Ukraine. There's absolutely no reason why Ukraine couldn't serve in a position in between the two, you know, where Okay, you can't put NATO troops up to Russia's border, but there could be trade and good relations between both sides. Modernization, there's certainly much to benefit from both sides. Russia has all of the gas and the natural resources, and Western Europe, the EU, has the technology. They don't have, their finances aren't so hot lately. They're not as rich as they'd like to believe they are, but they certainly do have the ability to help modernize Ukraine. So really, it should be a win-win. But there's this zero-sum mentality, and I think it's particularly true among Western politicians. But you know, what's even more ironic is you have people like Barroso, and you have the whole EU Commission hierarchy who's screaming about democracy in Ukraine and how they need to restore democracy, when none of these people are elected to their positions in the first place. You know, so none of these EU bureaucrats have been democratically elected, yet they feel suited to go around in Ukraine telling people that they need to restore democracy and this sort of thing.
You know, Daniel, I'm not sure if you're familiar with a website whose creator I featured on the program a couple weeks ago. I think it's goldenrulenews.net. I think it's .net or .org. I can't remember. I'd have to check it out. But it's called the Golden Rule News Network, and it will take a real news story on foreign policy, and then it'll change the names and change the countries involved so as to make an American reader think, gosh, what would it be like if we were treated this way? How would we feel? Well, I think you could take this kind of story and say, you know, look, whoever's in charge in the U.S. is probably some crummy jerk, but would we really be super happy if the Russians were funding some kind of, you know, murky movement of anti-Semitic right-wingers to take to the streets to try to replace it with somebody that the Russians want? Like, wouldn't we think that, look, we have our problems, but you know what? We'll solve them ourselves.
Yes. You know, there's a perfect fit for that, because McCain himself, who has encouraged these protesters from the beginning, as they occupy cabinet ministries in Ukraine, they're occupying the justice ministry and kicked out all of the people who work there. They've basically taken over government, and McCain is encouraging it. But you know, this whole golden rule thing is perfect, because on several occasions when peaceful protesters have attempted to enter McCain's senatorial offices, he's called the cops quicker than you can wink an
right.
eye and had them all thrown out.
Right, of course. Of course that's how he would act, and it's how he would act if he were in charge in Ukraine. I mean, he'd be doing exactly the same thing that he's criticizing them for doing. Well, in fact, what has been the Ukrainian government response? I mean, are we dealing here with a regime that is just so brutal that, you know, we have to abandon our normal neutral posture and say, well, look, this regime is just so brutal that I'm secretly rooting for the evil right-wing anti-Semites to take over? I mean, is that what we're facing?
Well, what's interesting is I can imagine them starting to lose their support because they've been too accommodating. Just in the past couple of days, the Ukrainian president has fired the prime minister and all of his government ministers, and he's offered prime minister and deputy prime minister positions to the leaders of the opposition. He pushed forth an amnesty bill that would let off the hook all these people that are burning down the ministry buildings, and they repealed these laws that made it more difficult to protest with masks on and these sort of things. So he's if anything, he's proven himself much more accommodating. But each time he gives something to them, they demand more because they're actually is adding more oxygen to the fire.
Now, has there been any official Russian response to the interference of the U.S., to, you know, visits of John McCain over to Ukraine? Now, Russia obviously has a bit of an interest in what goes on in Ukraine. Have they had any choice words for McCain or anybody else in the U.S. administration, as far as you know?
They've criticized U.S. involvement in it. And, of course, the U.S. says that it's all Russia that's doing the manipulation. And no doubt Russia has some interest in what goes on next door. We would feel the same way if it were Mexico or Canada. But, you know, we featured on the Ron Paul Institute site today an excellent interview that one of our advisors, Professor Mark Allman, did today, and he points out that Russia really views this as an economic deal between Russia and Ukraine, whereas the EU and the U.S. use it as a geostrategic repositioning, as a fight for geostrategy. So you have the two sides with very, very different things in mind.
So the U.S. then, from best I can figure out just as a guy on the street, the U.S. does not want to see Ukraine grow more friendly with and more closely allied with Russia. And so, therefore, we could tolerate the possibility of a regime in Ukraine that is, I don't know these right-wing parties. Maybe they're not xenophobic. Maybe they're just wonderful people who like Ukrainian history, so I don't want to smear them. However, I mean, knowing what I know, probably we're not dealing with the most savory people. The U.S. would rather have those people in charge if that's what it takes to keep some kind of a division alive between Ukraine and Russia. I mean, is that the motivation?
Well, I think these people could be easily dropped. I think they're going to find that they have been duped by this whole thing. They think that they will be placed into power, but the reality is they are very unsavory, and I think they'll find themselves shunted to the side. I mean, we saw this in several places after the so-called Arab Spring, where the people who the U.S. had sponsored to get out in the street had found themselves without anything once the revolution took place. So my guess is that's the case. But, you know, it's important to point out, Tom, that, you know, obviously you and I, you know, really don't care less because it's who wins because
it's none of my business, right? Yeah.
However, you know, and I've actually gotten a lot of hate mail because I've been critical of U.S. policy. They say that I'm against democracy, but even by their own standards, you have probably about 10,000 people in the street on a regular basis in Kiev who are protesting this. But Ukraine is a country of 45 million people. So, you know, say you and I, and, you know, not you and I because it would do it, but say a gang of 10,000 people were so angry over Obamacare that they started burning down the different buildings in Washington, D.C. and attacking them, that does not necessarily give them democratic legitimacy, you know, even if you might agree with their cause. You can't say democracy is involved because you can't measure a mob in a street and say that that's a majority. That's just not how it's done.
Well, what does your crystal ball tell you? How do you see this turning out? I mean, I know it's unreasonable to ask this question, but, yeah, you know, what would be the fun in not asking?
I think it will get appreciably worse in the next few days. I think the concessions have only encouraged the opposition to ask for more. I think there's a possibility that the president himself may resign. Who knows? I don't know that he has a stomach for this fight. But absent that, and absent something dramatic happening to set these people back, I think they will continue to ratchet it up. And you may see the other 44.9 million people finally getting irritated that their capital has been trashed, and you may actually see some serious civil unrest in the streets.
Well, this is not good news, and I'm sorry to bring you on to be the bearer of such bad news, but I did want people to get a bit of a handle on what's going on over there, because I think we hear about a country like Ukraine, and, well, I think most people don't know that much about it. They don't have any ancestral ties to it. We don't have many Ukrainian immigrants to the U.S. It just glides right over them. But to see what's going on and to know that the hand of McCain is on these poor people, it's a sad thing that we ought to be aware of, and I appreciate you bringing us up to speed on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, everybody, just wrapping up here, you know, I invited you guys to a live Q&A at Liberty Classroom, and I mean, you know, you can't win them all, right? You know, like, you have a bad day once in a while, and it just happens. I forgot to tell my web guy that the Q&A was open to the public, so a lot of you guys couldn't get in. Only my members could get in, and then I realized that halfway through, so some people got in, and then there were technical issues, and oh my gosh, it just reminds me, you can't win them all. So what I want to know is if any of you guys know of a service whereby I can stream professors from different locations, have two or three of us on the screen, and people can watch and ask questions, etc. If you can think of anything other than Spreecast.com that does that, and it can't be Vocal. I don't know if they're still around, VOKLE.com. It can't be Vocal.com because you can't record the session. I want a recording of the session so people can watch it afterward. If you know of something other than Spreecast, can you please write to me on the contact page at TomWoods.com? I would really appreciate that because I am highly dissatisfied with Spreecast. I'm looking for any other platform to do these Q&As with. All right, remember my upcoming speaking engagements, February 7th, Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland, February 8th, Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania, March 1st, College of Southern Idaho in Twin Falls, Idaho, March 5th, Washburn University in Topeka, Kansas, March 15th is the University of Central Arkansas in Conway, Arkansas, and finally, remember, you can get the details on that at tomwoods.com/events, and finally, tomorrow's the last day to get a free copy, free signed and personalized copy of my book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, with an endorsement by Ron Paul back before it was fashionable. That book came out 10 years ago, and Ron Paul was endorsing it in those days. You can get that book by signing up and joining libertyclassroom.com, where you can learn the history and economics and philosophy they didn't teach you in courses you can listen to in your car. They're taught by me. They're taught by Kevin Gutzman and other people you know and respect. So join me at libertyclassroom.com, and then on the contact page, send me a little note saying, here's my address. Please send me my book. And then finally, remember, you guys are helping us keep the lights on and keep my little Tom Woods Show office up and running every time you make your Amazon purchases through the little Amazon widget, entering Amazon through our widget at tomwoodsradio.com. All right, tomorrow, World War I, the neocons, American foreign policy, and more with Paul Gottfried. We'll see you then.
The Tom Woods Show.